This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The Washington State Medical Association is going to be meeting in Spokane. And this time around, it sounds like physicians, especially King County physicians, want to take a little more active role in some current issues than they've taken before, including global warming and gun violence. Dr. Teresa Gerolami is the president of the King County Medical Society. She's going to be attending. So what's changing here, Dr. Gerolami?
This year, the King County Medical Society, being the largest delegation and biggest county in the state, are going armed, so to speak, with 13 different resolutions, a couple of them being gun violence, clean air, lead screening in children, and many more. So what's changed is that we now want to have an active voice in these issues that are important to the physicians and the patients.
Now, does that mean, for example, I know this has been proposed in Seattle, doctors asking patients when they come in, along with the other, you know, have you had the flu, et cetera, do you have a gun in the home?
That's a great question. That's a little bit debatable, but yes, a lot of physicians do that. It's really important in the psychiatry field to ask those kind of questions, and that's come up in our board meetings as well. So yes, I think some physicians are doing that, but I'm not sure if all are.
Well, is your idea here to pass some sort of, to lobby for legislation or just a culture change or what?
Well, I think that we, we're here for our patients' health and we want them to live long, happy, healthy lives, and gun violence affects all of us. So I think there's many things on the slate this year, things like lockers and the age up to 21 and waiting periods and background checks. And I think those are many of the kinds of issues that will be talked about in the next few days.
But, I mean, if somebody comes in with a migraine, you can ask them if their gun is stored properly. How does that happen?
Well, I think it's part of a physical. Sometimes you ask things like, you know, how's your mood? Do you sleep well? Do you have children? What are their ages? Do you have a gun in the house? Do you keep it properly stored? I think it would come up in that kind of a conversation.
There, I saw in the news release a sort of, impatience. The doctors were fed up with seeing gun victim after gun victim and felt they had to do something.
Yeah, I think we feel helpless a lot of times when there's legislation without our voice being heard. So, for instance, this opioid thing that just got passed, I'm not sure who they consulted or what physicians' voices were in there, but now I know that I'm being told I have to take some kind of a test before January, and I'm not even sure where these things come from. So I think it's frustrating for physicians not to have a voice in these things that become legislation, and I think we like to change that.
Well, tell me about the opioid issue. What are they telling doctors to do now? I mean, I know they're telling doctors not to just hand out pills like they were popcorn, but
right.
What are they trying to do?
So now I think we're going to have to be educated, which I feel like most physicians are. I think this whole opioid thing on the physician front is few physicians, you know, maybe being egregious in their prescribing practices. But all of us now, I think, I haven't even actually read the mandate that we have to do before January, but it's some kind of education piece so that we are more alert and attentive, apparently, to the issue that they think we need to be more educated on, which in this case is opioids.
What would your solution to it be?
I think they really should crack down on the people that are causing a problem in overprescribing. And honestly, that is happening out there. And they are doing a good job, I think, of trying to curtail that. Education is a good thing. I think that patient education would be good as well. So when you give 10, you know, Vicodins and you say, that's it. They can't be running around doctor shopping and asking all these other docs to write, you know, multiple prescriptions, which I think does happen as well, or selling it on the street, which I think is an issue as well.
Yeah. And then the other issue that comes up is climate change. So you're going to take a stand on climate. I mean, we're all against climate change, especially if it means that the city's going to be inundated and our homes are going to be swept away. But you know, why are doctors concerned with that?
Well, I think physicians are concerned, and I think our resolution is titled Clean Air. Do you remember when all those fires were here this summer and that smoke came in? And so that increases the number of visits, like to my office personally, the asthma, the COPD, the people who have respiratory illnesses, that dramatically increased their illnesses and exacerbated many things. things. So the
don't
doctor...
breathe. Don't breathe smoke. I mean, that...
So what do you do about that? That's a great, great thing. So I think that the resolution actually addresses things like pollution. Doctors are trying to have a say in that because that is not good for our patients to have dirty air.
But I mean, that boils down to things like preventive burning and proper forest management and making sure that people don't throw cigarettes out of windows. I mean, how would a doctor address that in the course of his or her day-to-day work?
I think this is a bigger issue. I think this is one of those issues where we have to garner some support, get some solid data, and actually probably go to Olympia. I mean, I think this is a big issue that we need some help with the legislators, but I think maybe they don't understand the impact on the actual patient. The smoke this summer was a really great example of how people really were sickened by the air.
Actually, what we need is some sort of anti-smoke pill, like everything else. On smoky days, you pop a pill and it somehow cleanses your system.
You and I should invent that because we do need that.
Dr. Teresa Girolami, who is the president of the King County Medical Society, and thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
There will be no more executions in Washington State. The 8 death row inmates here will now have their sentences commuted to life without parole following a ruling from the state's Supreme Court. But that has had some consequences that you might not expect. Here's our radio's Hannah Scott.
So the court invalidated the death penalty law in our state, finding that it was imposed in an arbitrary and racially biased manner. That decision came in a challenge to the death penalty case against murderer Alan Gregory, a black man who was convicted of murdering a woman in 1996. The Supreme Court had already upheld that conviction once, but on his second go-around with the court, his lawyers argued more on the racial fairness issues. The court relied heavily on a study out of the UW that found in death sentences, black defendants are about 4 times more likely to get the death penalty in Washington than white offenders. Now, that same study also found significant county-by-county variations in the application of the death penalty, something King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg cited as one of the reasons that he now opposes the death penalty. He also says the death penalty is no use to prosecutors anymore since appeals are often dragged out 20 years and cost millions of dollars.
Families who have suffered such a terrible loss and have, they feel like they won something if they have a death penalty verdict. But the truth is that that just means the case is going to go on for decades and it is vulnerable to appellate reversal.
Governor Inslee echoing that sentiment as he praised this ruling yesterday.
It is a torturous experience. We now have finality. Those families aren't going to have to wait 20 years to know what's going to happen.
But not all families agree. Lisa Hamm's sister, Monroe Corrections Officer Jamie Bindle, was murdered by an inmate already serving life in prison in 2011 and is devastated by this court decision.
They say that it's going to be equal justice for everyone, but it's not. It's not equal justice for Jamie. They're argument is they will be in life without parole, but obviously you know that Jamie was killed by someone who was already in for life without parole.
And that means for her killer?
He got away with murder. He absolutely got away with murder because he was already in for life without parole, and so there is no punishment for him. He will get to go ahead and keep living his life in prison like he was before and maybe murder someone else.
And she worries about the message that this sends to inmates who are serving life in prison and the danger it puts other corrections officers in.
Who's to say it's not going to happen again, especially now that all of the inmates who are serving life without parole can go ahead and kill any other correctional officer and have no consequence.
And she feels like this was all politics, and it appears to be a done deal because the challenge before the state Supreme Court was on the state constitution and not the federal constitution. This cannot be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The state court did rule that the death penalty was unconstitutional as applied in our state, which leaves open the possibility of the legislature tweaking it to bring it into compliance. But Republican State Senator Mike Padden doubts there's an appetite for that. And with the governor already promising a veto if they did do that, Padden says there's really only just one option left for trying to revive the death penalty in our state.
The other option would be if the citizens, which they've done in the past, wanted to enact it through initiative. The initiative seems to be the only practical way to do anything to me right now.
Well, that would still subject it, though, to a racial fairness test. You may recall back in 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court banned the death penalty nationwide. because of racial disparity. And the Washington State Supreme Court is now saying all these years later, there is still enough racial disparity, even in this state, which I think we'd agree is a fairly progressive state along those lines,
yeah,
that it was unconstitutional.
Right. So, and he admits that the bar has been set exceptionally high by what the state court said in its ruling yesterday when it comes to that. So it's a long shot. For now, he says in the near future, we don't, he doesn't expect to see the death penalty applied in our state.
So when we say there's no more death row, does that mean those prisoners who are in those cells now get moved back to the general population?
Okay, so the DOC is making those arrangements now where they're going to go. I have not heard for sure if they're going back into general population. I can tell you that Jamie Bindle's sister just told me that she hopes that's what happens to her sister's killer. He is, you know, in Walla Walla. She wants him sent back to Monroe into the general population, which I don't know that that would happen. We'll see.
Why?
She thinks something might come his way if that happened.
I see. I just wanted to make sure because that's what it sounded like you were saying.
But, yep.
So there might still be a death penalty in Washington State.
And she hopes. And, you know, that case is a rare case. So and I asked the governor about this and Attorney General Bob Ferguson and others and Dan Satterberg. It's one case where this guy was already serving life in prison. So there is effectively no consequence. He's now still serving life in prison. So he will pay nothing for the murder of Jamie Bindle. That's the position that they have. It's a rare case. The response I get from the governor and everyone else is that this is not about one case. This is about equal justice for everyone. So
Well, you could also argue that once Gary Ridgway was absolved of the death penalty, essentially, then how could you justify ever executing anybody, right?
Right, yeah. And that argument goes on both sides, though. Prosecutors argued heavily. Those who argued in the legislature this session when they were considering abolishing the death penalty, they wanted to keep it because it is important leverage to get that kind of information for families. So there are both sides of this. You know, Jamie Bindle's sister had been going for, and her father, for that matter, had every year gone down and lobbied hard to fight for this, and that fight's over for them now, but she tells me that doesn't give them any closure.
Guy Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Ballots go into the mail on the 19th, so by the time you get them, you should have about 2 weeks to weigh your options and return that ballot so your vote counts. Many of you have already made up your minds. We called up Anthony Salvato, CBS's Director of Elections and Surveys, and being that he is the Director of Elections and Surveys, and based on the results of the 2016 election, I had to ask him, should we still trust polls anymore? Does he still trust polls anymore?
Well, I do them, so I hope the answer is yes. The answer is yes. And here's why. I know why you're asking that. A lot of people ask me that after 2016. And my answer always is you should look to pollsters for an explanation of what's happening and not merely for a prediction of what will happen. The fact is we've got an argument going on. We've got a debate going on. That's what a political campaign is. So we don't necessarily take out our crystal ball and tell you what people are going to think in 6 weeks. But we sure can tell you what people think right now. And that's the thing you want to do with polls. It's what you want to do with pollsters. You know, in 2016, the polls, the national polls especially, were a lot better than a lot of people thought. But a lot of the predictions about what would happen going forward really discounted the fact that a lot of people changed their minds late, and that can happen, and that a lot of the focus would take place in a couple of key states, and folks were looking at the national numbers instead. So here again, look at the numbers that are going to matter. And then, yeah, you can trust them, Dave.
This has been billed as a referendum on the Trump administration, but really it comes down to a relative handful of swing districts, correct?
Correct. And that goes right to that point you raised about looking where it matters. You don't want to look at the national polls this year. You want to look at the competitive House races. There are about 60 of them out of the 435 that are up. That's where we're concentrating our polling. And, you know, if you look at those, over the summer, they'd been edging toward the Democrats, enough to get them just over that line of majority control. Well, there's still possibilities where the Republicans hold on to the House. And what determines that, what to watch, is whether or not a lot of these new voters show up. Sounds like we say that every year because it's often true every year. But there are a lot of people who tell us that they vote in presidential years, but this is the first time they're going to get engaged in a state, in a Senate, in a CD race, in a midterm. Well, we'll see if they actually do. I think it's about 1 in 5 voters right now. They're breaking more for the Democrats. And so the Democrats are really dependent on changing what is normally a more conservative and older electorate. We'll see if they can do it this year, Dave.
Well, I just want to ask you, we seem to have two sets of polls going. We have this overall poll Do you identify as Democrat or Republican, which is a national poll? But that doesn't really mean anything, right? I mean, what matters is how you identify in those particular districts. So if you confine, if you confine the analysis to those competitive districts, which side has the momentum?
Well, that's why I'm glad you raised that, because that's why with our battleground tracker, and I'll do a little look ahead. We're putting out a new one on Face the Nation on Sunday morning. Our battleground tracker, we actually concentrate in those competitive House races, and we give you a seat estimate from those races, not just a national number, because, yeah, I mean, those national numbers include places that aren't going to necessarily swing the House. So I think that when you look at those, I think that what the other determinant here, the other thing to watch, is people who say that the economy is good, but they're nonetheless unhappy with the direction of the country. And that's something we don't always see. Usually the party in power, if the economy is good, gets not only the credit, but gets the voting advantages. But we don't see that as much this year. And a big factor in that is the president. There's people motivated to go out and support him, but there's a lot of Democrats who said they're motivated to cast a ballot in a local race that they see as in opposition to the president. So it's been nationalized in that regard. But as far as what will actually swing the House, no, that's a handful of districts. You're right, Dave.
One more thing. Did you piggyback any questions about who Democratic voters might be likely to consider as a presidential candidate in 2020?
No, very intentionally so. You know, you mentioned that point at the top about trusting polls. Look, there's sometimes when a poll doesn't really tell you anything meaningful. And quite frankly, a question about 2020 candidates right now doesn't tell you anything meaningful. You want to look and see what the candidates are, who they're going to be, and what they start to say. I'm old enough to remember when Jeb Bush was the leader for the Republican nomination. So that'll tell you all you need to know about the 2020 polls.
It was Jeb! Exclamation point. Don't forget that.
Hey, indeed.
CBS Director of Elections and Surveys, Anthony Salvanto. Anthony, thank you.
Thank you much.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, joined by movie man Michael Medved, and the story of the first man on the moon. What's to retell here?
Well, this is a focus on Neil Armstrong, who was the commander of that Apollo 11 expedition that actually made it in July of 1969. The performance by Ryan Gosling, who is again teamed with the director Damien Chazelle, the same director who worked with him so memorably in La La Land, works remarkably well. This is not like a lot of people thinking of The Right Stuff or thinking of other space exploration movies like Hidden Figures, which was a fine film. This is not obsessed so much with a space program as it is with the very personal life of one individual. And the irony here is Neil Armstrong became a world hero, but he was a very inward guy who was very sparing with his emotions. Part of this movie struck me very personally. I mean, the film goes into some detail about Neil Armstrong's involvement with the Gemini program, which preceded Apollo. My dad, may he rest in peace, was experimental director for the Gemini program.
Really?
Yeah, and he knew Neil Armstrong and a lot of the people who appear in the movie. By the way, the performances are universally strong.
Neil, if it does turn out, you'll go down in history. What kind of thoughts do you have about that when the thought hits you? Gosh, suppose that flight successful?
We're planning on that flight being successful.
I just meant how you feel about being a part of history.
I think I can shed some light here. It's a responsibility, but it's exciting to be the first. If my wife is excited, she keeps slipping jewelry into my PPK.
You're planning on taking some of her jewelry to the moon, Buzz?
Sure. What fella wouldn't want to give his wife bragging rights?
Neil, will you take anything?
If I had a choice, I'd take more fuel.
The whole film begins, really, with what the filmmakers and the writers behind it, and by the way, Steven Spielberg is one of the executive producers. It's from his DreamWorks company. They assume that the decisive event in Neil Armstrong's life was the death of his daughter, Karen. who was 2 years old, an adorable little girl, and she died of a brain tumor before her third birthday. And according to a lot of sources, but not all, that actually scarred Neil Armstrong and led him to this sort of laconic, withdrawn, moody sort of individual that he was. Very unlikely guy.
Wow. So why would they want him to be the leader of the mission?
Because he was stable.
Yeah.
He would not take risks. He could respond well. And there is one sequence here, and it's true. It's all based on the actual event, where it is Neil Armstrong's coolness, his unflappability, his inability to be rattled or to get too high in emotions or too low, that actually saved the lives of himself and his crew.
I don't know what space exploration will uncover, but I don't think it'll be exploration just for the sake of exploration. I think it'll be more the fact that it allows us to see things that maybe we should have seen a long time ago.
The film is just gripping to watch. I've got to say I loved it, because the recreations of space travel are actually much better than we've ever seen before. And
it's scary, isn't it?
It is very scary. And what's shocking is you see the technology. And this, after all, is 50 years ago.
Yeah.
The idea that these guys are going into these little spaces where they are strapped in, where terrible things can happen, and then you're being exposed to these extraordinary variations of temperature and pressure.
Well, have you seen the capsule of the Museum of Flight, how small those things are?
That's exactly right. And boy, do you get a sense of that here.
The thing I remember, I mean, I was a huge fan of the space program.
I was just one of those
geeks. But I remember watching that live picture from the moon right before the limb blasted off to go back, wondering whether it would move or not. Right? Wondering whether it had enough fuel to get back up to the mother ship, so to speak. And when that thing just sort of, it popped up like a cork, I said, wow.
Yeah.
They pulled it off.
Well, this returns that sense of wonder and that excitement, and you do end up on the edge of your seat, because the film Damien Chazelle puts you right there. And after Whiplash and La La Land and then this, these are three very different films, but all masterfully handled by this young director. Three and a half stars.
For First Man. Michael Medved, thank you, Michael.
You bet, Dave. Great to talk with you.
I didn't realize Neil Armstrong made that comment, though. If I had a choice, I'd bring more fuel. Yeah, me too. Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. It's morning drive time in Seattle. It's tea time in London. Do you have any inside sources on how the trip went so far for the Seahawks, if they're feeling good, if they're well-rested?
I think you could listen to the end of Dory Monson's show and find out how members of the pregame show were feeling.
Yeah.
It sounded like Dave Wyman felt quite relaxed.
Really?
Perhaps even jovial.
Interesting.
Perhaps tipsy.
Really?
Oh.
Why would that happen?
Well, because he had been in a pub before then.
He was
encouraged to return to the pub. Then after he told Dory that, Dory, you can ice my crotch anytime, Dory stated, well, maybe you shouldn't go back to the pub. Perhaps you should go directly to your room and go to sleep.
Oh.
He used the term ice my crotch. Of course, that means something different in England.
No, Dory spilled a drink on his lap.
Oh. My goodness, I missed that. I'm going to have to replay that.
Yeah.
Well, I assume that the rules would be a little stricter for the Seahawks.
The Seahawks players, yes.
In terms of what
they
can
party.
Consume.
There's going to be curfews. That's actually something people don't know. So when I cover the NBA, there's no rules on players in the NBA. Like, guys can stay out as late as they want. They just have to get to the shooting ground the next morning. And then even then, they have time to go take a nap before the game. NFL players, you've got security guards stationed on the floors of the hotel.
Seriously?
So they
yes.
can't leave?
Correct.
And they're on a strict diet too, right? Don't they have dietitians that follow them around?
Yes, that's true. But most players like that part of it. But I'm sure if they wanted to sneak in a pizza, they'd be able to do that.
Mm.
But yes, they do. But it's mostly, I mean, there's bed checks and there's
what?
Actual, yes. Like, it's absolutely, they don't have free run of the place.
Whose job is that?
Well, they have a whole security staff. Mostly,
they go around and check to make sure there aren't just stuffed pillows under the sheets.
Yes, you have to be in your room. You have to physically answer the door so they can see that you're there and that no one else is in there.
And what happens if you are not in your bed during bed check?
Well, then I'm sure you get fined. Perhaps it escalates to the point where you get waived or released.
Really?
Like, I mean, there's...
Is that serious?
Yes. They don't mess around with, hey, can I go out on the town? There was a player a couple years ago. He was a practice squad quarterback, and they went to Miami. So I think it would have been 2012, and he was on the practice squad. He didn't show up back at the hotel the night before the game, and he got to the stadium as the team was getting there, and he tried to pretend like, oh, yeah, I've been here all along.
Slipped right in.
That didn't work. He was looking for a new job when they got back to Seattle.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, you guys remember, I mean, think about the Super Bowl, the infamous Super Bowl, not ours, but the Green Bay Packer wide receiver went out and partied it up with flight attendants from the night before the Super Bowl, was hungover, wasn't expecting to play much. He ended up catching touchdowns in the Super Bowl and ended up, it's like one of the all-time great stories from the 60s kind of era of Super Bowls.
I guess we could pull it off.
That was a different era. Do you have more international stories or do you want another bed check story? Because I got a decent one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's about local scoundrel Jeremy Stevens.
Yeah.
They were in Cleveland. He was not going to play. He was injured, but he was on the trip. And he paid someone, that the elevator comes up to the security garden. Ding! It's like 3 a.m. And there's a guy in a top hat with a handle of Jack Daniels, a fifth, and a pizza. And he says, I got a delivery for Jeremy Stevens. And the security guard says, huh. So he goes and knocks on Jeremy's door, and he said that there's a guy here that says he's got some stuff for you to deliver. I would suggest you tip him well. And it turns out that Jeremy had to hire a limo because that was the only way he could get a pizza and booze delivered to him at that time.
Oh,
so he peels off $500 bills to have the security guard give to the guy. And so the Seahawks security guard goes and pays the guy, gets the pizza and Jack Daniels, and goes back to Jeremy's room and says, thanks, Jeremy. You know there's no food after curfew.
Oh.
Said Jeremy Stevens never spoke to him again.
Yeah.
Is this just the Seahawks rules or all the teams like this?
Most NFL teams are like that. Yeah, I mean, each team has its own varying degrees. It should be pointed out, Jeremy Stevens was a special breed of criminal.
So for your colleagues who are in London right now, what is the temperature of Londoners with the NFL in town?
This is the thing. The game will sell out. There's enough expats over there and random English folk who like professional football, tackle American football, to go to the game. The thing I hate the most about these games is it always becomes a conversation about, when are we going to have a team in London?
Yeah.
There is plenty of evidence that Europe has no interest in American football.
All right, so that hasn't changed this year.
No,
we've gone over that. I just wondered if this year was different.
Yeah, we had a league, a European football league with the Rhine Fire and the Frankfurt Galaxy and the London Monarchs.
Terrible nicknames.
Yeah, the Scottish Claymores.
Are we expected to beat the Raiders Sunday?
Yeah, we should beat the Raiders. Heck yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
And I believe there's a game between the Huskies and the Ducks coming up.
Yes.
Who wins that?
The Huskies better.
Easily, right?
Well, I'm nervous.
Give us the score.
The score of this game is going to be 70 to 21.
70 to 21. That's going to be close. 2 years ago.
It's going to be closer than I'd like.
I can guarantee you of one score. Before noon or kickoff, one of my brothers will at least have had 10 beers.
Are you serious? Honestly, the score that I would pick is 31 to 28. I think it's going to be a very, very tight score.
31 to 28.
That's correct.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, I'm very nervous.
Yeah, we're plus or minus on the 10 beers for my brother. Sorry.
And Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers.
Hey, did you hear I made a song about the game?
I did.
Yeah, have you heard the song?
We already played it.
No, you don't want to play it again?
No.
Where can people hear it if they miss it?
Cletus, the slack jaw duck fan.
Just no time. I sure wish there was time, but darn it, there just isn't.
Well, where can they hear it if they missed it yesterday?
They can email me and I'll send it to them.
It's on iTunes.
U.S. has had a pretty good relationship with Saudi Arabia, certainly when it comes to selling military equipment, but a lot of that is being jeopardized now by the reported murder of a journalist and former Saudi insider by the name of Jamal Khashoggi, who went into the Saudi embassy in Istanbul to get some marriage papers, the council to get some marriage papers. And Stephen Portnoy has been following this story now. We're getting these intelligence reports that he was, in fact, murdered, and the body was dismembered. Are these leaks from our CIA, or where is that information coming from?
I don't have the answer for you, Dave, but I can tell you that this story is being broken by the Washington Post, which has been in the lead in this all the while. Remember, Jamal Khashoggi has been a contributor to the Washington Post, has been a columnist for that paper, and so this organization, the Washington Post, has been out in front. The report this morning on the front page is that there are audio recordings, or at least one audio recording, of Jamal Khashoggi being interrogated and ultimately murdered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey, a week ago Tuesday. The White House is not commenting on that report, and members of both parties say that there is some U.S. intelligence that they've been able to take a look at. At the same time, they are frustrated that the U.S. intelligence agencies have not been more forthcoming with members of Congress about what it is that they might know about all this. So the story here is one of apprehension and also deep concern. Members of both parties are leaning on President Trump to be more forceful than he has so far been, and to talk about imposing sanctions on Saudi Arabia and canceling the planned purchase of more than $100 billion in arms in a deal that the president himself helped push through and hailed when he traveled on his first overseas trip to Saudi Arabia last spring.
Right. And the other story we saw this morning was the pastor being released from Turkey, this pastor who'd been arrested by Turkey on trumped-up charges. And as I understand it, one of the reasons this happened is because the president played hardball with Turkey. He threatened tariffs, or actually imposed tariffs, didn't he, on aluminum and steel?
Yep, imposed the aluminum and steel tariffs, and also directly sanctioned Turkey's interior minister and justice minister. And that was a very bold step to take against a NATO ally. An important strategic ally in the region. This is the result today of intense pressure that the Trump administration put on the government of Turkey. And what you heard from top U.S. officials was that this should have happened months ago, and they expected it to happen months ago. The sanctions were put in place 2 months ago in early August, and negotiations had gone back and forth between the U.S. and the Turks. Ultimately, today, in Turkey, you had the court acting to release Andrew Brunson, who had been living in Turkey for like 2 decades as a pastor of a Christian church in the environs of Istanbul. I'm not sure if it was in Istanbul proper, but long story short, the Turks had accused him of spying and aiding terror groups. And as you mentioned, Dave, the U.S. has always viewed those as trumped-up charges.
Right.
He's a native of North Carolina. The North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis, who's been leading this effort, has said that he has been released and is now in the process of being transferred to a third country. We assume it's going to be Germany, and we also assume it's going to be a U.S. military airplane that'll take him home to the United States.
Okay, so now if you do that to get the release of this pastor, I mean, now we're talking about a journalist who is just outright murdered and then butchered. So it would seem like you'd want to play hardball with them, too.
Sure, as you also played hardball with the North Koreans after Otto Warmbier's death, and ultimately in the relationship with North Korea, you've got the release of the other Americans who have been captive, and it's a complicated thing. But what further complicates the relationship with Saudi Arabia is the fact that there's money on the table, and there has been money on the table in the pocket of President Donald Trump over the last 2 or 3 decades of his career. Mm. And so this is a very intricate, complex dynamic at play. The president said in the Oval Office yesterday when speaking to reporters that he does not believe that the U.S. should cancel the planned arms sale because it means, you know, $100 billion for Boeing and Lockheed and Raytheon and other defense contractors, and ultimately the jobs for the people who would create those weapons programs or whatever it is they're buying. And he said essentially it's not worth canceling purchases over this one individual. He described Jamal Khashoggi as certainly someone that we should all be concerned about, but also someone who's not an American citizen, as if to say it's not really our problem. I mean, well, forgive me, I'm putting words in the president's mouth. I will tell you that Jamal Khashoggi has been living here in the D.C. area for many years and had been, as I understand it, a permanent resident of the United States. And typically, we refer to those people as Americans when they establish residency here. They might not have passports, but they certainly are eligible to apply for citizenship and are on that track. And that's why a lot of people were really surprised to hear what the president said about it yesterday. At the same time, the president has said he's very unhappy with the situation. He says it's not a good thing at all. They don't like it in any way. Mm-hmm. The question now is what Mr. President, are you going to do about it?
But this is such an outrageous thing to do. Let me ask you this. Is there a possibility, I'm just raising this as speculation, that somebody in Saudi Arabia might read the president's generally negative remarks about journalists and figure, this guy's only a journalist. He's a safe target.
I don't know. I hope that's obviously not what, I obviously hope that's not what has happened. I can tell you that there is a close relationship that is widely understood and well documented between the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who is at one point been looked at as a reformer and at the same point has sort of been seen as this man with a strong hand who's been leading a crackdown against critics as well as those who are seen as corrupt within the Saudi kingdom. And it's a very awkward situation now because this president and his top advisors have developed this close relationship with the Saudi government. Remember last year, and I mentioned this, we were with the president. I flew on Air Force One with the president as he made his first overseas trip. And it wasn't to London or Paris or any other place in the world. It was to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
And he said that that trip was one of the highlights of his life.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Stephen.
You bet.
Stephen Portnoy.